A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hey, it's me again, Virginia Priest from Brooklyn, New York, and you are listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Virginia, from Brooklyn in New York, for returning as an intro of the Tennis Podcast, Catherine. We like it returning everything, don't we? We like returning mascots. We like returning shout-outs. But an intro is pretty cool to start off this show, isn't it?
Yeah, returning dogs is the best. Returning humans is a very close second.
So. Okay.
Thank you, Virginia.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks, Virginia. Matt Roberts
it's
is here
Virginia
as well.
Wade, is it?
It's she not. In, no, it's Virginia Priest. In,
Well, Virginia Wade lives in New York. That yeah. Is why so I ask.
You're getting a bit of a shout-out comparison name as well for your money there, Virginia. So thanks very much. Matt Roberts is here. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Yes, I am between trips. I've done lots of laundry and I'm ready to go again.
Sparkling.
His pants are clean, guys.
big moment here on the Tennis Podcast. If you'd like to introduce a show like Virginia, you can do so by becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast. The link to do so is in your show notes. And you can also get a shout out as well. And then from December the 8th is when we reintroduce pet mascots, guest editors, executive producer slots. You can take us on in predictions. That is all coming up in the next couple of weeks. Right, we've got lots and lots of tennis to catch up on from Turin this week, where Catherine sits in her hotel room after eating another gourmet meal. What implement were you using to eat it with, Catherine?
Yeah, same one as before, David. I've repeated my mistakes of the past.
Right.
So you're... But it worked really well the first time. I'm actually surprisingly expert now at eating salads with bottle openers.
It's like a party trick. Fantastic. So well done for that. How has the week been? What is Turin like versus a year ago? Atmos-wise, staging-wise? What have you made of it all?
Well, it's got Jannik Sinner, which it didn't have a year ago. I do think that is a difference. The crowds here are fantastic. I think it's been sold out every session. I mean, there's a dead rubber happening at the moment in the singles, and both players got an uproarious welcome onto court, which, had I been a ticket holder tonight, you know, being the sort of privileged tennis goer that I am, I'd have been extremely disgruntled and probably not cheering that loudly for the players coming onto court. But they were giving it so much welly. So yeah, the crowds are special. It's one of those where it's the biggest thing happening in this city at the moment. You know, it's very much that vibe and not the big city, all sorts of things happening. This is just one of them, New York type situation. It definitely feels like everyone in this city knows the tennis is on.
I like that. That's really pleasing, and it comes through the TV. I have to say, the atmosphere, the fervor. Really, I mean, it feels like it is a step up from last year. I'm sure that Sinner is the main reason for that. I was also made the point that the next gen finals isn't taking place this year in Italy, and therefore they've got even more resource to put behind this, and they can just focus on this. And I mean, it does look incredibly well staged. I mean, it does look as if it's just been picked up from the O2 Arena and put in Turin. But I don't know, maybe even better to some degree. Matt, in terms of lineup for the semi-finals, which is where we stand right now as we talk to you, yes, there is this match between Zverev and Rublev going on at the moment, but it doesn't matter. Those two are both out. And it leaves tomorrow night, as we speak to you on Friday night, it leaves Novak Djokovic against Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner against Daniil Medvedev. I mean, that is pretty much, if you could have asked for a lineup for a semi-final, would you have gone for that?
I did. On WhatsApp earlier today, I said I would like to see that semi-final lineup, please. And it did happen. And it feels right. Those have been, by far and away, I would say, the four best players this year. I mean, some sort of categories within that as well. Obviously, Djokovic has won the three slams and Alcaraz has got a slam. But, you know, Sinner and Medvedev have both had really great runs of form during this season as well. Medvedev more at the start of the season and then picked it up again at the US Open. And Sinner, obviously, sort of... Well, actually, ever since he was sick on the court against Grigor Dimitrov, Jannik Sinner has turned into this incredible player who seems to have sort of leveled up and sort of accelerated. And yeah, he's been, as Catherine suggested, really, he's been the sort of star of this tournament so far. And I think we've got two fantastic semi-finals to look forward to. We've got Medvedev trying to overturn now that sort of head-to-head, which is moving in Sinner's direction against him. You know, Sinner's won the last two, and Medvedev taking on that Turin crowd is something I'm very excited about as well. And then Djokovic-Alcaraz remains the match in men's tennis because of, you know, the sort of generational gap between them and just, you know, how good they both are at their best. I think, you know, we all were really high on that rivalry through the summer, but we obviously haven't had it since Cincinnati. So I'm very, very excited to see that again. And already I am, you know, just aware that I'm going to be up late tomorrow and I have a very early alarm on Sunday morning. But it's fine because I will be watching Alcaraz Djokovic rather than sleeping. That's a good thing to sacrifice sleep for.
Yeah, that's a decent enough trade-off. Listen, we'll get to preview those two matches, of course, and we'll all have our say once again, I'm sure, on the pros and cons of round robin. But actually what they have done is produce some interesting storylines, it seems to me, within the course of the week. And actually, I think, you know, really Jannik Sinner's route through, I think when we spoke on Sunday night, Catherine, he just played his first match, hadn't he, against Stefanos Tsitsipas. And really the drama took place after that in the next two matches. He beat Novak Djokovic for the first time in an absolute cracker of a match. And then he beat Holger Rune in a match he didn't actually need to win last night, which ended up keeping Djokovic in the tournament. I mean, Sinner has been the story in just about every way.
Yeah. And if you think that's the case sort of for neutrals, you can't even imagine how bananas the Italians are going for Jannik Sinner. You know, we're talking cartoons in Gazzetta dello Sport where Novak Djokovic is handing his crown to Jannik Sinner and placing it upon his head. I mean, talking about sort of just hours and hours of rolling. I don't know whether they've got a dedicated news channel for Jannik Sinner yet, but we feel it feels like we're nudging slowly in that direction. They know what they've got in Sinner for sure, and they definitely feel like this is the moment. Obviously, the fact that it's happening in Italy helps, but he is a talented young player who's destined for great things that hasn't had the big moment yet, I don't think. And this, I think, feels like it, and maybe even sort of on a smaller scale, that win over Novak Djokovic was it. He was unreal. I mean, he beat Novak Djokovic in a deciding set tiebreak. That that pretty much anyone that knows anything about Djokovic in tiebreaks, that tells you what you need to know. I think the hitting from the back of the court was sublime. The way he's timing the ball, the way the flight of the ball over the net, it just looks so sweet. It's beautiful from Jannik Sinner. There's also some definitely encouraging signs in terms of variety in his game. It's not there yet, but I'm more convinced by it than I've ever been before. I think the court helps with that. The altitude helps with that for sure. But he's showing some hands and some dexterity that I think is developed from what we've seen previously. I do just have in the very back of my mind, and we might get a test case for this, it is very possible that Jannik Sinner and Novak Djokovic will meet in Sunday's final. Would Djokovic be losing that match if it were a knockout match? I think Djokovic was giving his all, just as Jannik Sinner was. I just think there is a different gear to Novak Djokovic when it's win or lose, when it's life or death. He has a historically poor record in second round robin matches in the ATP finals, and I don't think that can be an accident. So there's a part of me that wants to see that match in Sunday's final to find out the answer, but then there's also other parts of me that want to see every other combination of the various possible matchups we could get in Sunday's final. So I'll kind of be happy with anything and everything from this point. But I don't know, I'm interested in your thoughts on the match, on his third match against Holger Rune, that he absolutely didn't need to win. And some would argue it might have benefited him for him not to win, because he would have sent Novak Djokovic out of the tournament. It didn't surprise me that he put full effort into that match, given how big a deal he is here to the fans, given the money available to an unbeaten champion. The money differential is massive. I know it's a bit crass to talk about money, but the sums are so significant at this event for the men that it's significant even to multimillionaire tennis players. So it didn't surprise me at the outset. I expected that to be an incredibly competitive match, as if it were a knockout. However, when Jannik Sinner started showing signs of injury, that was when things changed to me. We probably need to expose ourselves for our hot takes in our WhatsApp group, which were so completely wrong about that match. But it surprised me, given the evident injury, how much he continued to put himself on the line in that third set. And again, time will tell. We'll be reconvening on Sunday to see how our takes age. But it could cost him. Definitely could cost him.
Yeah, because he was clutching at his lower back halfway through or early parts of set number two, after he really ran away, rolled over Rune in the first set, 6-2. He was playing beautifully. He was incredibly loose. I'm not that surprised. He knew he was through. The crowd were loving it. And he is, you've highlighted before when he played Davis Cup and when he played Chirinic 2 years ago, how good he is in front of one of these crowds. You know, he doesn't shrink. He's up for it. He gets energized and inspired by it all. So I wasn't that surprised that he was loose. I was maybe a little surprised that Rune looked as tight as he did, and he really didn't seem to have much conviction and confidence on the ball. And then he turned it around to a degree at the start, and he was aided, of course, by Sinner looking a little impeded for a while. And it would have been very understandable if Sinner had either retired, you're quite right. I said, I was the first one to say it, this will either be Sinner in two or Rune in three, because it got close at the end of the second set and I saw no possible way really that Sinner could outlast Rune in a match that he simply didn't need to win, and one that if he did win, he would end up keeping Novak Djokovic around. Not that that is going to be in his mind consciously, but like, there's every reason to not bother really giving 100%, maybe saving a little bit, or not running for the absolute final 0.1 of a percentage out to your right to get that ball that you're struggling to get to. There wasn't a bit of that. He was so rugged and so up for it. And I've seen this kind of bravery before from him to some degree. When he's cramping, he doesn't give in very easily. He's trying to win. What impressed me is that he managed to win against a guy who also loves a scrap in Runa. And I think he's shown that in back-to-back matches in for different reasons there. He's playing the ultimate match manager in Novak Djokovic, and he's outlasted him in a tiebreak. And then he's done it against Runa, who needs to win the match. And I just think it was bloody impressive. I do think you're right, though, Catherine. Anybody reading into that will predict the future when Novak Djokovic is concerned, needs to remember the difference between that guy at Grand Slams and must-win matches and everything else.
I'll let Matt share his views here, but I just wanted to say that it's a blooming good job that Holger Rune loves a scrap, because he seems incapable of having a tennis match that's not a scrap.
Well, what are you most impressed with Sinner about, Matt? I mean, I know generally you've maybe been more up on him than we have over the years, but I mean, this is a clear step up again. But it feels like on a couple of or more than a couple of different levels.
I think the main thing for me is, you know, it wasn't that long ago, it was this season, that Sinner was our new "why do I lose all the close matches" guy. And, you know, I think particularly at Slams, you know, and I think there is still that, I don't want to say question mark, because I'm not that unsure of it. I feel like Sinner will get there at the Slams. He hasn't had a chance to play a Slam since he's found this new gear, this new form. But, you know, he was losing a lot of five-set matches. And I think what's impressed me is that he's won these two in such tight circumstances. And I think, you know, he's got such a big game that, you know, he needs to commit to it, and he's still been committing to it even in the very tight moments. I mean, that final set tiebreak he played against Djokovic was unbelievable. He simply took the racket out of Novak Djokovic's hand. The guy who goes into a lockdown mode and is used to winning in those moments, he didn't really have a say. Sinner was just way too good. So that impressed me massively. And honestly, I've really enjoyed seeing him get the crowd's adoration, because he's not necessarily the guy that you would necessarily would think would be traditionally that kind of player. You know, he's quite introverted, and, you know, I think it's wonderful sort of what happens to him and what happens to the crowd watching him in Italy. It's a really special thing. And of course, not to throw it ahead too much, but I mean, there is also the chance that Sinner and Djokovic could meet in the Davis Cup as well. They're potential semi-final opponents, Italy and Serbia. So we could get a sort of hat trick of Sinner Djokovic matches potentially. And I think each one with this little bit of a more edge that Djokovic will have. You know, I think he's spoken so much about how much he wants to win the Davis Cup this year for Serbia. So if they were to meet there as well, I think that would be really interesting. But yeah, it's very hard for me to imagine Djokovic losing twice in the same week to the same opponent. Like, as good as Jannik Sinner is, we just know that Novak Djokovic has got another level, and how good he is at getting revenge over players. You know, look how he beat Carlos Alcaraz in the next match after they played that Wimbledon final. He just is so good at not letting players get a hold over him. So if they were to meet again on Sunday, I guess I would still be backing Djokovic, but that isn't to say that Sinner hasn't impressed me absolutely massively, because he has. And that was a match that Novak Djokovic, you know, absolutely did want to win, and Sinner was right there with him and sort of took it from him. It was incredible.
My feeling was quite early on, I felt Sinner would win because of it being a group match, and because Djokovic came out toe-to-toe with him, and he absolutely hitting the ball as clean as a whistle. It's actually a beautiful sight to watch him redirect the ball the way he was in that first set and not just dig in and play, kind of see if he can get it past me tennis. Not that he does that all the time, but you know what I mean? He was coming out to seek and destroy in the match and take Sinner on and knock him off the court, it felt to me. But there's a little bit of impatience about him when he's playing like that, as though I just can't be bothered to do what I always do. I just want to knock you off the court and get out of here. There was a bit of that about him, and that's what made me think he was vulnerable to losing the match. And also, I think that plays into Sinner's hands, because Sinner loves to stand up and just take people on toe-to-toe. What about this semi-final he's got? He's playing Daniil Medvedev, and Medvedev won his first two matches pretty comfortably, both straight sets over Zverev and Rublev. And then today he had that slightly awkward situation of knowing he's already through and he's playing Carlos Alcaraz. We'll save Alcaraz as a talking point. I just want your thoughts, Catherine, on Medvedev generally. Do you feel like he is playing as well as you've seen him play at this event? I mean, he won it, of course, a couple of years ago, didn't he? Or 3 years ago? Can't remember. Did he win it? Mm. He's won this before. Yeah.
Yeah,
2020.
Right? 20 at the O2.
Oh, yeah.
That was it.
Oh, the dark one.
Yes. And
the one where I lived at the O2, a post-apocalyptic O2 arena for the week.
That's right.
It's no wonder you've tried to erase it from your memory.
I mean, look, after two matches, I think he was the player that almost looked in the best form. Maybe him and Sinner equally. Now he's lost one. What do you think for this match, Catherine? The form you've seen Medvedev in, the record he has, which is very positive overall against Sinner, but as Matt said, Sinner's started to make inroads.
I think Medvedev across the first two matches against Rublev and against Zverev was playing as well as anybody. Honestly, it was going a lot less noticed than Jannik Sinner. Kind of the story of Medvedev's year, playing really well, but being somewhat in the shadow of either the famous Carlos Alcaraz or Novak Djokovic, or just not ever quite being the man. I suppose there was a period at the start of the year where he was winning all those titles, but even then, it didn't lead to a Grand Slam, did it? So you could still make the argument that there was somewhat of a shadow. He was in somewhat of a shadow. So, yeah, this tournament has been kind of the same. He was stunning, I thought, for those first two matches. Just, you know, all the precision that you expect from peak Daniil Medvedev, moving brilliantly. He's so comfortable on this court. One of those matches where you're watching and going, bloody hell, how does he move that way for a guy of his shape and size? One of those matches where you're struck by how Daniil Medvedev doesn't make sense. You're looking at him going, right, okay, that's what he's doing, is it? Yeah, such precision, such cleanliness from the back of the court, always seeming a step ahead of his opponent. That's how it felt against Alexander Zverev. As soon as their rallies went over four shots, you're like, okay, Medvedev's probably got this. He's playing a game of chess now, and it's, unless you're going to pull off something spectacular, it's over for you. And that was kind of how the match played out. But that wasn't the case today against Carlos Alcaraz. And there are so many different factors potentially at play in today's match. I don't know how much weight to give one versus the other. I think Medvedev was dulled by the fact that he had already qualified, and the fact that losing took out his foe, Alexander Zverev, and potentially set up a more favourable semi-final matchup for him. Now, you could argue that either way, Sinner has been getting the better of their recent matchups, but it certainly, I don't think, gave him a less favourable matchup in the semi-final, Medvedev. Yeah, points and prize money, all of that, but I think there was an edge taken off Daniil Medvedev today, for sure. And I also think that things changed for him after losing the first set. If the edge wasn't taken off in the opening set, it certainly was in the second set. I definitely don't think he was in a place where he wanted to get dragged into a marathon, especially being on the side of the draw that gets 24 hours less rest ahead of the semi-finals than the others. Having said that, Carlos Alcaraz was a completely different animal today to what he was in his opening couple of matches, and he was fantastic. It's the first time, it might be the first time that I can remember indoors at any tournament indoors, and that's not that big a sample size, that I've seen Alcaraz with the proper Alcaraz sparkle. The first time he's properly looked like Carlos Alcaraz indoors. I think maybe we've been kidding ourselves a little bit, or less so you, David. I think you've actually been pretty realistic about how dulled Alcaraz has looked as a force on indoor hard courts versus other surfaces. But don't want to get ahead of myself, because it feels like one step along a learning journey. But there are echoes of Queens, you know, here for Carlos Alcaraz. Remember how shaky he looked in his opening match at Queens against Artur Rinderknecht. He very nearly lost that match. And then, as I recall, can't quite remember who it was against, but I think it was his third match at Queens where it suddenly looked like, okay, he's grasping this now. He's got it. He looks comfortable. He's doing his thing. He looks like himself. And I had a similar feeling about him today. So whether it's enough against a six-time former champion tomorrow, I don't know. But I'm damn glad that Carlos Alcaraz is in the final four.
Still trying to get my head around me being the most realistic of us when it's talking about Carlos Alcaraz. But, yeah, I did say at the outset that he looked all at sea. And I agree with you. I think this is the first time we've seen the real deal. The first real sight of Carlos Alcaraz on an indoor court. I can't remember seeing it before. And it was a timely reminder, because I needed it. I wanted to see the pizzazz, you know, the one who just makes you go, oh my word, what's he doing? Because nobody else can do that. Nobody else can do it quite like him. They've all got their own thing. I think Sinner has been providing breathtaking power and really making people stand up and take notice of what he does from a baseline. Djokovic, well, he needs no introduction, but Alcaraz does have something that none of them have. In as much as he almost has what they've all got when he's absolutely at the very top of his game. And yeah, we saw it wasn't all the way through in this match. There were some still the odd patchy bits, I felt, but generally speaking, the clarity of thought of how to use his creativity, how to use his options, was there today with the foot speed, with the reliability from the baseline. And he reminded you why he'd got that record against Medvedev in that match today. And when he's serving and volleying or hitting off-pace shots behind Medvedev that are making him turn and suddenly having to realise he's been wrong-footed and then having an answer for the pass or the lob or the dink cross-court, whatever it was, it was all there today. And he looked like he was having the time of his life. That's the other trademark feature of Carlos Alcaraz, isn't it? Isn't this great? And the crowd were responding in the same way. So that's him. But I felt like this was only a one-off. Like, he's worked towards that like he did at Queens. I'm not saying it's a one-off and it won't happen in the next round, but it's the only time we've really seen it. And now he has to play Djokovic, which I find his form a little bit difficult to assess. And I don't know about you, Matt. I don't really see that Djokovic's form, his other wins, I just, none of it seems relevant to me. It's, tomorrow's a completely new day. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair. He's played a lot of three-set matches, hasn't he? I mean, all of them this week. He played a lot in Paris as well, which, you know, is perhaps an indication that he's not quite at his peak level. I think peak Djokovic would have been winning some of these matches a bit more efficiently than he is. So, you know, if I'm Alcaraz, I'm maybe clutching at that straw. But you're right. It's a different ball game when it's knockout and it's, you know, right at the peak end of the tournament. I'm expecting peak Novak Djokovic. Just quickly on Medvedev, I think this is quite a big weekend for him. I think when you look at his recent record against the other three in this semi-final lineup, he's lost five of his last six against Djokovic. He's lost three of his four against Alcaraz this year. And he's lost his last two against Sinner. Like, it took probably one of the best performances he's ever had to beat Carlos Alcaraz at the US Open. And, you know, I just don't think you can expect to play like that all the time. Sort of feels like he is there with them, Medvedev, absolutely. But recently, these players have been getting the better of him. So I think, you know, if he can win the semi-final and get to the final, I think that would be like a big step, like a big moment for him. I just have this slight sense that the others are just, I don't know, just slightly better than him at the moment. And I think he's sort of out to prove that wrong. I hope so, because that's very much my favourite Medvedev. But yeah, that's just the slight sense that I have comparing him to the other semi-finalists. I feel like he needs a big win over one of those, which maybe sounds silly because he did win that US Open against Alcaraz, but sort of big picture, he's been losing to those three quite a lot.
We might get to meet a new favourite Medvedev tomorrow, Matt. We might get to meet Medvedev versus 13,000 Italians.
Oh, come on, let that happen.
I mean, Djokovic versus 13,000 Italians was pretty fun. His conductor move was one of my moments of the week.
But yeah, same. I enjoyed it. But again, just maybe going back to what David was saying earlier, this from that, I got a slight sense that it wasn't peak Djokovic in that match, because it was quite playful with the crowd. And when he's really on it, he's not playful. He's not taking any shit from them whatsoever. He's using them and turning it into sort of motivation. He's cold with the crowd when he's sort of using the crowd to enhance his performance, which we've seen him do for years. This was a bit, yeah, as I said, playful is sort of the word that comes to mind.
It was a bit Medvedev-like.
It was a bit, yeah.
There was a slight twinkle in his eye while he was doing it. It didn't feel kind of, yeah, cold. Cold is exactly the word.
But he doesn't do that as well as Medvedev. Like, Medvedev does it playfully, but he's also an absolute killer in the moment. Djokovic ends up looking a little bit distracted and not really himself. So, yeah, I agree. I think that he was loose. He was loose in that match, and he won't be loose tomorrow. He'll be just bang on it.
I do think it could get fun with Aggie Medvedev against Sinner tomorrow. Yeah.
Hell yes.
That would be splendid. Okay, then. Listen, the truth is, you know, here we sit on Friday night. We've got these two semifinals coming up. It's Sinner Medvedev at 2:30 local time in the afternoon. It's Alcaraz Djokovic 9 p.m. local time. So it's 8 p.m. for us in the UK tomorrow night. What do you think? Who's winning them? Why? Catherine?
Oh, David.
You can't avoid this. You've been asking everybody for their predictions and you're on the spot.
I think it's going to be a Djokovic-Sinner rematch.
Me too.
But I can see any scenario. I think they're all in the mix. I wouldn't be surprised by any scenario, but colours to the mast, Djokovic, Sinner, with Djokovic winning.
The court really suits Medvedev, doesn't it? Like, it's fast, it shoots through. It if he serves,
it's a proper hard court, and he is a specialist, so
yeah,
he would know.
It probably least suits Alcaraz. would you say?
Well, that is what he said after his first match, isn't it? He lost to Zverev, and I've only seen the quotes written down. So, you know, take them as you will. They could have been delivered, you know, with a wry smile, but he was pretty chippy about the speed of the court. He said it's fastest hard court I've ever played on, fastest court I've played on all year. Of course, the altitude is a contributing factor to that. 300 meters doesn't sound like much, but it's certainly enough to make a difference. Personally, I think it's a pretty much perfect speed of indoor hard court. I think the court is conducive to very watchable tennis. I'm a fan. I can understand Alcaraz being a bit shocked by it. If it, you know, he was making his debut, wasn't he? He hadn't played on that court before, but he's grown so much in comfort. I doubt he'd say that now.
I think it's another link to the grass. Like, I think at the start of the grass court season, we might have said, "Oh, grass doesn't suit Alcaraz." But then when you see him playing well on it, you're like, "Oh, well, actually, he's got a really nice slice backhand, and he likes coming to the net, and he's got good touch, and suddenly his game sort of makes sense on that court." And I think that's the same with a fast hard court. He's got really good hands, he's got variety, and that's all things that are helpful on a fast hard court. But I do think that Djokovic and Sinner, you know, if he beats Djokovic and then were to play Sinner, I do think both of those will be able to rush him a bit more than Medvedev was able to today, with, you know, just given their court positions. You know, they're much happier taking the ball earlier and just sort of rushing Alcaraz in a way that, you know, as you said, it looked like the previous Alcaraz-Medvedev matches today. You know, Alcaraz sort of exploiting the space that Medvedev left. But he won't be able to do that against Djokovic and Sinner. And I think that element might still take a little bit of time for it to come. So that's probably why I would back Djokovic and Sinner to meet again in Sunday's final.
I don't feel like Alcaraz has had enough wins to be ready for this. This is a different level. So he's beaten Rublev, who really isn't comfortable on that court at all, and didn't play well this week. And it's the first time they'd played each other, and it really suited Alcaraz, I felt, the Rublev game. And he's beaten Medvedev, who he's got a winning record against and who didn't have to win. And maybe that took a little bit off him. I know that might be being a little unfair to Alcaraz, but that's kind of, that is something that was at play, and whether it was a factor or not, it's impossible to know for sure, but I would guess it did take a little bit off him. And that's only two wins coming off a really not very good run. For a while, I think if you were in a Grand Slam and they were meeting each other and he'd had five wins, I'd feel differently about it, especially if it was, I think he's better outdoors. I do think he's better with elements and all those sort of things. So I'd go for Djokovic as well, but I'll put him up against Medvedev in the final. I think, you know, there's a reason that Medvedev beat Sinner, what, six times? It's a lot of wins. And I do think the conditions suit him perfectly, and yeah, I think, and I, there is a question mark over the fitness of Sinner. Okay, he did well to fight through that third set. Mm. He said it was nothing, but he would say that, and it's impossible to know whether he's fully fit or not. But it's definitely at least a little factor that makes me think I would probably therefore go for Medvedev, because I'm pretty sure he's fully fit. Medvedev Djokovic final is the one I'm expecting. But you're right, any one of them would be fantastic. And I think we can count ourselves feeling pretty smug and lucky that we've got this particular lineup in the semifinals to look forward to.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or on your smart TV in HD.
Sounds great. There's genuinely nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere.
And can I just sit and watch court Susan Longlin all day?
You sure can, David. Wherever the stories are, the rivalries emerge and the generations clash, you can watch it all with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Be there when it happens by subscribing to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription.
So, earlier on in the tournament, just a couple of other points to cover off here. Stefanos Tsitsipas, we mentioned, lost his first round-robin match that he played. We covered that against Jannik Sinner. And I remember he came into the tournament, there was a doubt over whether he was really fit, wasn't there? Remember he pulled up in practice just on the eve of the tournament. And then he played three games against Holger Rune and then withdrew. Now, this wasn't the elbow injury he's had problems with in the past. It was a back injury, I think, Catherine, wasn't it? And, he got some pretty hostile treatment from the crowd. I'm not that surprised, really, after three games. I mean, I feel sorry for him if he's injured, you know, obviously. But three games, that ain't a lot of tennis.
Yeah, I sympathise with both parties here. If I was in that crowd, I'd like to think I wouldn't be booing, but I'd probably feel the same as the people that were booing, because it's a tough ticket. You're dependent on one match. That is the situation. Yes, you get the doubles, but let's face it, that's a starter, isn't it? You're buying the ticket for the singles. And okay, they served up an exhibition match, an exhibition set between two alternates, one of whom was very clearly injured and not fit to play. And I think that's pretty questionable from Taylor Fritz to sign himself up as an alternate, for which you get a pretty hefty check, knowing you're not fit. And I assume he knew he wasn't fully fit because it's the same abdominal injury which caused him to pull out of Paris. Now, maybe it turned out to be more of an issue than he realised. I don't know, but that was certainly a very unedifying spectacle, the Hurkacz-Fritz exhibition set. I found it tough watching Tsitsipas end his season injured and booed off court. That's, you know, I feel for him, that's really tough. But equally, I mean, tennis players are selfish, aren't they? I don't think he intended to make anybody in that crowd feel the way they ended up feeling. I'm sure that wasn't what he wanted from the day. But equally, I don't think they were a factor in his decision-making about whether to give it a go that day. You know, Tim Henman and others on our coverage on Prime were pretty clear that when you hit prior to a match, you need to go full pelt, essentially recreating match conditions to establish whether you are fit enough to play. And in the comments he gave, he said he felt it in the warm-up, but he thought he would give it a go anyway. Now, that is absolutely his prerogative. He's earned his place at that tournament. That is within the rules. But equally, he received a heftier check for taking to the court than he would have done had he not taken to the court. And I understand why the crowd were incredibly disgruntled. Now, you could ultimately argue this is a glitch with the system that allows for, if not kind of encourages, this sort of situation to arise. But I do I feel for everybody involved. It was a really flat afternoon. It was really tough to be somebody leading a broadcast on that session of tennis.
Mm. Yeah. We also had the sight of Andrei Rublev once again smashing his knee with the racket frame six times, one after another, drawing blood. I mean, looking as though he'd really swollen his knee. And I mean, he was hitting himself as hard as he possibly could in his second group match. And I don't know, I've spoken a lot over the last year or so about how much it bothers me and how much I feel terribly sorry for him that the moment is doing that to him and he is unable to handle it. But I can't watch it, and I turn it off when he starts doing that, or I certainly don't want my kids seeing that. And he's somebody who's made real strides in the last few months in terms of his results and his performances and also his mental health during those sort of moments. I understand he had a bad cold this week and he really was feeling under the weather. He certainly wasn't playing well, but this was a massive regression. It may be temporary, but you know, he was hurting himself, like physically harming himself during a match. And it's just upsetting to see it and distressing. And I don't know whether anybody can do anything about it. I don't know a bit of me started to think, you know, is that like unsportsmanlike conduct or bringing the sport into, you know, disrepute in some way? But then he's doing it to himself. It's not like it's not a racket smash and which there are penalties for. You don't seem to get penalized for doing that to yourself. And I don't know whether that would be a good idea. Is that helping him? Because that's kind of what I want him to be helped, but I also don't want I don't want my kids to see that and think, oh, that's how you behave on tennis. Andrei Rublev's doing it, why shouldn't I do it? Really, really bothers me.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with tennis. I mean, whatever is coming out in those behaviours when he reaches boiling point on court, that's pretty profound stuff. I've absolutely no idea what the root cause is, but he's clearly such a good egg, Andrei Rublev, but there's also clearly demons there that he needs help identifying and dealing with. And I really hope, you know, people in the sporting world aren't always the most emotionally in touch and emotionally intelligent or emotionally enlightened. I've no doubt he's surrounded by people that absolutely want the best for him, but I've no idea whether he's surrounded by people that are the best judges of what is best. I really hope he gets what he needs.
Yeah, me too. The doubles semi-final lineup tomorrow. Things start before those single semis with two doubles matches. The first semi-final is going to be Marcel Granollers and Horacio Zabayas against Rohan Bopanna and Matthew Ebden. That's at 12 o'clock local time, so 11 o'clock for us here in the UK. And then the evening match is Santiago Gonzalez and Edouard Roger Vassalan against Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury, who, it reminds me, Catherine, you know, before the US Open, they were having a terrible time, weren't they? And they are a seriously long-running partnership now. If you consider we've now got Neil Skupski and Wesley Kulhoff splitting, they won Wimbledon together. I got the feeling from Ram and Salisbury that, you know, they were starting to question things a little bit earlier in the year, but they wanted to stick together, and then they got the benefits. The dividends finally came in and they won that US Open. But they keep on plodding along, don't they?
Yeah, like backing a football manager through a rough patch. Mm. It seems all too rare in doubles and indeed in football these days. So I'm really pleased for them that faith has come good. And they're now on an 8-match winning streak at this tournament because they went unbeaten to the title last year, and they're unbeaten They've come through the group stages unbeaten this year, and I would have them as favourites to go on and win the title again. They've looked very convincing to me. The Kulhoff-Skupski one is interesting and controversial, I think. By all accounts, Wesley Kulhoff delivered the news to Neil Skupski, his partner with whom he's had a great deal of success, in Paris this year. Not Roland Garros Paris, indoors Paris, that he wanted to end the partnership and he'd be partnering with Nikola Mektic next year. It surprised me full stop that they were splitting because of how much success they've had. They finally won that long-awaited slam this year. It surprised me even more to hear that it wasn't for a same nation partnership. I would expect some surprise splits in the season, at the end of the season before an Olympic year. I remember Wesley Kulhoff played with, hang on, was it Mektic then?
Mektic and Pavic joined up, didn't they?
Mektic and Kulhoff split after winning the tour finals, I think, in order for Mektic and Pavic to get together for the Olympic year. That made total sense to me. This one sounds pretty brutal. Neil Skupski was left floundering around trying to find a partner. Now, I understand from some investigations that Laura Robson has done, actually, that Neil Skupski is going to be teaming up with Santiago Gonzalez next year, and that is because Edouard Roger Vasselin, Santiago Gonzalez's current partner, is going to be teaming up with Nicolas Mahut for the Olympic year, an all-French partnership. So the carousel keeps on a-turning.
It's all very dramatic. And meanwhile, Bapana and Ebden still got a chance to finish the year as the world number one pair, which is... I always get pumped when Rohan Bapana has a chance to do something, because how is he doing it? I mean, he's 43. He's unreal.
He's got a grey beard.
Oh, what a player he is. I mean, that is a seriously dynamic pair, you know, when you watch them on the court. The interception, the volleying skills of those two... God, they are serious talents. Anyway, they need to reach the final in Turin to pass the already eliminated Ivan Dodig and Austin Krajicek. They're in the top spot at the moment. Kulhoff and Skupski can no longer finish the season at number one. So, we'll find out. Santiago Gonzalez and Roger Vasselin and Granollers and Zabias, well, they must lift the trophy to move to number one. So it's all in play, Matt. Who is going to do it? I'm going to put you on the spot to tell us which doubles pair is going to finish number one.
God, what a horrible question.
Yeah. Let's have it.
Let's go with Bapana and Ebden. That'll be fun.
Agreed. That's who I'm going with as well.
And they only need to reach the final. So they only need to win one more match, right?
It's going to happen. I want to see those scenes. That'll be fun.
I think they will reach the final and clinch number one, and Ram and Salisbury will beat them in the final. There you go. Unsolicited, detailed prediction.
Good work, Catherine. That's what we like. Okay, well, we've got it all to look forward to. Tomorrow, Catherine will be presenting the live coverage on Prime Video in the UK, and we'll be watching. And then we'll be coming back on Sunday evening, won't we, with a new tennis podcast to review the semifinals and the final. And then Matt is off to Malaga for Davis Cup finals.
I will be in Malaga for that Sunday pod.
Oh, will you be joining us from Malaga? That's very exciting.
Well, I hope so, if I'm invited on.
Yeah, we're in trouble if you don't. Anyway, let's hope you are. Anyway, we've got a fantastic mascot for this edition of the Tennis Podcast. It is Ted. Ted is a Pomeranian Terrier, 7 years of age, owned by the very lovely Mark Forbes. Mark is the kit man for Southampton Football Club. Mark's been a long-time supporter of ours, as has Ted, and Ted loves chasing tennis balls, listening to the tennis podcast, and getting up to mischief with granddaughter Aria Violet, aged 2. Catherine.
Aww.
How lovely.
Yeah, we know and love Ted and Mark.
Yeah. You've met Mark, haven't you, Matt?
I have, yes. I met him last year. He was very kind to source some tickets to Southampton Fulham for me and my dad. Unfortunately, it was the day that Southampton got relegated.
Awkward.
It was a slightly awkward vibe. But okay. We had a lovely day, and Mark is a delight. And he is, as you said, officially the kit man. That title does not do justice to what Mark Forbes does at Southampton. I'm convinced that the football club would fall apart without him. He was telling us what he does, and it seems to be sort of everything. He is great.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Mark and Ted, for being the mascot for this edition of the Tennis Podcast. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, if you have a pet that would like to be a mascot of the Tennis Podcast, from December the 8th, we're taking submissions for the year of 2024. And we'll be having weekly mascots throughout the year, and your pet could be one of them. So, keep across our social media and our newsletter, of course, for news of when those opportunities go live on December the 8th. We have our own mascots, and they will also be available for 2024 as well. We've got Maisie for me. We've got Xenia for Catherine. We've got Darwin for Matt. My Andrei Rublev prediction didn't do too well, did it? But have you two still got any stakes in the draw?
Yes, well, I went for Medvedev.
Okay.
Mm.
Who you've now decided isn't going to win. Matt?
And I went for Sinner. So we are facing off in the semi-finals.
Oh, well, that's all very dramatic and exciting. We have Billie Jean the Dog, sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And now, at this point of the show, I would be asking Matt for shout-outs, because we do have them. However, Catherine's Zoom has frozen. So at the moment, we can't hear her at all. So we're going to say goodbye for this edition of the show on Catherine's behalf, and save shout-outs for Sunday night's show, Matt. How does that sound for an idea?
Sounds like a great plan. And they're good shout-outs. So we've got something to look forward to on Sunday.
I'm pumped already. I'm pumped for the semi-finals as well. They're coming your way tomorrow, and for the final on Sunday. We'll be back on Sunday night. And then we got a week of daily podcasts from the Davis Cup finals. Matt will be in Malaga. Can't wait for all of it. We'll speak to you soon.